today we have Deborah Lacombe with us to do her, it's becoming an annual tradition to do her Chapter 39 update for us. You all should have received a document this morning from Liz Damski with that Deborah's going to be going over today, and you've previously received the statutory updates in our newsletter, and then I know Deborah also sent out an email to everyone that had the complete text of the new Chapter 39, so you may want to have all of those documents in front of you today to refer to. Deborah is the Deputy General Counsel for our statewide office. She provides legal support and advice to both our Executive Director and to the General Counsel. She specifically works on legislative issues and was instrumental in working on Senate Bill 1080, which is the bill that resulted in many of the changes to Chapter 39. The bill was a result of a collaboration of the Guardian, the Department of Children and Families, the courts, and other dependency stakeholders who got together and drafted the bill to not only bring Florida more in compliance with the existing federal legislation, but to also address some more concurrent case plan issues and to really clean up Chapter 39. And as you know from working with it for the past 3 weeks, there are some pretty extensive changes. I'd like to, at this time, turn it over to Deborah. And again, if you could please put your phone on mute, and if you have to put us on hold, make sure that you do not have music playing in the background, and hold your questions till the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Kay. The document that you received this morning is basically a selection of some of the changes in Senate Bill 1080. It was a huge bill, huge changes. And as Mary Kay mentioned, it was primarily designed to conform Florida law to federal law so that when the federal government representatives come and evaluate us in their CFSR process, that we're not losing money and our kids aren't losing money. The other focus was to expedite permanency. So I think it's going to take a long time for everyone to kind of get in the groove of all of these changes, work out the kinks, figure out how to best utilize the new statutory language to help kids. But one thing that I'll say to you is if the language seems burdensome or like it's going to make things take longer or it's going to be worse for kids, that I would say probably take a step back and think to yourself, am I really interpreting this right? Because there was no other agenda. This was supposed to be better for kids and make life easier for practitioners. And if it's not happening that way, then maybe, you know, take a minute to read it or something like that. The pieces that I selected in the 7-page document that was sent out this morning were the things that I thought you might be seeing right away that you would need to be aware of, changes that are affecting the orders that are being submitted, the motions that you can make. So this document does not represent all the changes in Chapter 39. It is basically a summary of the most immediate changes from Senate Bill 1080. So with that, I'm just going to go through and I'm going to try and cover as much as I can. I'll probably stop about 5 or 10 minutes before 1 o'clock and do some questions. I'd like to give everyone my contact information now, and I'll give it again at the end of the call. It's Deborah.Lacombe, L-A-C-O-M-B-E, at gal.fl.gov, and my direct line is 850-414-2435. If you don't have time for questions this afternoon, if you would like for me to send you some materials or talk to you and or your staff, I'm happy to do this. I think I'm excited about this, and I think all of you should be too. A lot of this language was guardian ad litem input. Mary Kay said I was instrumental, but I was really just the guy who was in the room representing program positions. There was a work group of directors and program attorneys and case coordinators who worked since last July to look at language and come up with ideas. So I feel like you guys should be really proud of this product and excited about implementing it. I'm going to go through and make references to the Blue Chapter 39 books. There are 3 circuits who have their books still in transit. I apologize for that, but hopefully most of you have them already. So starting with shelter on 39402, if you look at page 67 in your book, you will see that the one of the things that was done in order to make sure that Florida was in compliance with federal law was to give greater clarification to the kind of findings and the sort of information that had to be presented at the shelter hearing. The reasonable efforts requirement is huge in federal law, and if the department does not provide the judge with its reasonable efforts that were provided, and the judge does not make that finding in the shelter order, the child loses all Title IV-E funding, if eligible. So what we have here is greater detail on these reasonable efforts findings. You need a description of the services that could prevent or eliminate the need for removal. If the services are not available, a determination has to explain why they're not available. That's new 39402.10. Later in 39402, some other changes were made. A new subsection 17 was created. This is one of the efforts to expedite permanency for children. Here, the court is required to ask the parents whether there are relatives who might be considered a placement for the child. And as many of you know, there's been tons of case law on this in the last year. This is an effort to try and get relatives identified right up front. The parents have to give the court and the parties the identification and location information regarding these relatives. And then the court is going to advise the parent that he or she has a continuing duty to give DCF the information about these relatives. So there's a shift here to get the parent more involved in making sure that if relative placement is really what's best for this child, the parent has a continuing duty to go to DCF and say, you know, my Aunt Sue just moved back and that's really better for foster care, so that we're not all fighting about this on the eve of TPR. The guardians ad litem should be checking the shelter orders for this language. You should be looking at the shelter petitions that DCF is filing and making sure all that reasonable effort stuff is in there. If the reasonable efforts justification are not in that petition, go ahead and, you know, you should have an attorney at your shelter hearing asking questions of the caseworker, asking questions of DCF as to what was done in order to ensure that the child was not unnecessarily removed. Another new section, subsection 18, this is on page 68 now in the book, requires the court to advise the parent if they fail to substantially comply with the case plan, their parental rights can be terminated and the child's out-of-home placement can become more permanent. This is language that is in other places throughout Chapter 39, but again, in an effort to expedite permanency, it was thought that if the parents are on notice, right at the shelter hearing, that they may be more motivated to go ahead and begin their case plan tasks, or, you know, to do whatever's necessary to ensure that their participation and their compliance with the case plan is good enough to get their child back. One thing I also want to mention to you, which is not in Section 39402, but rather in Section 39407, is that section now has new language which authorizes the court to order someone who has custody or someone who is requesting custody to submit to a substance abuse assessment or evaluation. That can be done any time after a shelter petition is filed. There's also language to this effect in Sections 39507 and Section 39521. But if you've got substance abuse issues in a case, the judge or the guardian ad litem or DCF can move as early as shelter to begin addressing those. And many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the research regarding substance abuse treatment. It doesn't always fit neatly into the 12-month time frame that we have, and certainly not the sometimes 9-month time frame that may come once case plan approval is given. So if you can start the ball rolling with substance abuse assessments and treatment when necessary at the shelter hearing, you may have a better chance at reunification or getting this child into an appropriate placement. The other thing I'll point out about the changes to 39507 and 39521 is at that point, once you have adjudication or adjudication withheld, The court can also require the person who has been assessed to participate in treatment, and that includes a treatment-based drug court. So if you have dependency drug court, now the language in Chapter 39 clearly authorizes the court to use that resource. So that's shelter. And now I'm going to move on to case planning, which is on page 102 in your blue book. There's lots of underlined language in the case planning section, but what I will tell you is a lot of it is just moved around and an attempt to be streamlined so that, you know, you could find all the sections on developing the plan, all the sections on the tasks and services in one statutory provision. Some of the new provisions, though, that I want to mention are some language both in Section 39-6011, subparagraph 1, and 39-60113 that explains what it means to participate in case planning and what it means to sign the case plan. This language, it provides that this is not an admission or consent. So this is an effort to get parents to participate in case planning, to go ahead and sign the plan. It was a discussion during the development of the bill that there were people being advised or people who believed that if they didn't sign the case plan, then they weren't admitting to whatever. And so this is clear that the participation and the signing is not the same as consenting to the dependency, and hopefully this will inspire parents to begin to participate more fully and to go ahead and sign the plan. There are some new contents in the case plan, 39-6011 sub 2. The permanency goal has to be in the case plan, as well as any concurrent planning goals. And also, again, as we saw in 39-402, written notice that failure to substantially comply may result in TPR, and that material breach can result in TPR before the compliance period expires. And there's some important language on material breach that we'll get to later. 39-60116 provides that if the parent's compliance with the case plan necessitates that services begin before case plan acceptance, the department has to make the appropriate referrals for services that allow the parents to begin the agreed upon tasks and services immediately. So if you have a task that's going to take 11 months and you're not scheduled for case plan approval hearing until, you know, say 2.5 months into your case, the department needs to go ahead and start making those referrals so that the work that has to be done on the case plan is consistent with the time frames laid out in the statute. So there are all kinds of ways that the department's work with the case plan doesn't exactly line up with Chapter 39, and this is sort of a recognition of that. If the tasks are going to take longer than the 12 months because you wait till case plan approval, you have to start earlier. And, of course, probably a lot of you will remember that at the shelter hearing, if the parents ask for, this is also consistent with the provision in the shelter hearing that allows the parents to ask for provision of services. If they volunteer to get services, the department has to provide those to them. So again, more opportunity for people to start early. The guardian ad litem should look for opportunities to encourage people to get their services started, even if it is in advance of the case plan approval. 39-6011 sub 6 provides that once it's agreed upon and signed, the case plan should be given to all parties. That's old language. The child gets the copy of the case plan. That's old language. But new language in here allows the case plan to be provided to any other person as directed by the court. If you have a case that has a concurrent case plan, and maybe, you know, someone is Aunt Sue is the concurrent case plan goal placement, she ought to have a copy of the case plan. So if you see something like that, it is appropriate to ask the court to provide the case plan to non-parties. So watch for opportunities to involve more people if that's going to help the child reach permanency faster. Another big change for the case plan is found in 39601-2, subsection 2, requiring that certain health, mental health, and education information and records of the child be attached to the case plan and updated throughout the JR process. So often we hear complaints about how children are being moved from one placement to another, and maybe the new placement doesn't know which medications the child has or doesn't know that he or she goes to a particular physician. This language is designed to ensure that the information about the child's health is following the child. 39601-18 requires that the case plan describe a process for making certain that this information follows. So in addition to looking for these documents in the case plan, you'll need to make sure that your case plans are specifying, you know, whose responsibility is it to ensure that the child's school record is attached. How, you know, making sure that this package of information is really following the child. That's case planning generally, and now I'm going to spend some time talking about case plan amendments. And this, there are some pretty massive changes in here, beginning on page 105 in your blue Chapter 39 book. The first thing I want to mention, though, is actually not on that page, but rather in section 39701-9D. That was the only place in Chapter 39 that provided statutory authority to extend a case plan. And as you all remember, that was at the JR hearing, 12-month JR, for extraordinary circumstances, the case plan could be extended. We've heard a lot from dependency case stakeholders that the extraordinary circumstances were often that the parents didn't have time or the parents were in partial compliance and they were going to be given more time. Well, no more. That language is gone. There is no more extension of case plans in Chapter 39. You amend, you don't extend. And if you look on page 105, in section 39.6013, subsection 4, it specifies the circumstances that can justify a need to amend the case plan. Previously unaddressed condition, the child's need for permanency, failure of a party to comply, or an error or oversight in the case plan. Again, there is no parents are partially complying or we need more time. So that's a pretty major change in Florida law that we're no longer going to be extending case plans. Now, in order to amend your case plan, there are two different standards that you need to be aware of. If you are going to change the goal, use concurrent planning, or add or remove tasks for the parents, you are looking for a you need to justify that by a preponderance of the evidence standard. If that is new, that is higher than what we had before. Previously, it was competent evidence, and that is still the standard if you are going to amend the case plan to provide services to the child. The philosophy behind that is, to the extent that the parents are ordered to comply with certain tasks based on an adjudication of dependency, that is done by a preponderance of the evidence. So if you are post-adjudication and you're changing something that the parents have to do, then that's also going to be done by a preponderance of preponderance of the evidence. And that's because, as we all know, material breach of the case plan or failure to comply with your case plan after 12 months are both grounds for TPR. So we're going to use the preponderance of the evidence standard in both situations. That, I think, is going to be something that takes a long time for people to get used to. But I do think the feeling of the stakeholders was that it would be a positive change and that you might be duking it out and having some longer hearings at the case, you know, at these amendment for case plan hearings, but the expectation for what the parents were responsible for and the reason that they were responsible to do it would be clearly laid out in the motions and in the order. And then if you do have to go back and use that for a TPR, you would have it all done by a preponderance of the evidence standard. Concurrent case planning is the other big thing in the case planning section. This has always been something that we have been able to use in Florida, but there's been no guidance in Chapter 39. Section 39.01.18 now defines concurrent case plan as establishing a permanency goal in a case plan that uses reasonable efforts to reunify the child with their parent while at the same time establishing another permanency goal. So this is not, there have been case plans, I've seen a lot of them that will say, you know, primary goal, secondary goal. That's not the same. Because in your primary goal, secondary goal world, you work on the primary goal until it's no good anymore, and then you go to the secondary goal. Concurrent case planning is you're working on both things at the same time. It is not linear. You're doing it on a, you know, these two tracks are running parallel, and everybody's working on both goals at the same time. You can use concurrent case planning at any time, but Section 39.701.9e requires that at your six-month JR, the court has to look to see what the court has to evaluate the case and make findings regarding the likelihood of reunification within 12 months after the child's removal from the home. If the court makes a written finding that it's not likely that the child will be reunified in that time period, then DCF is required to file with the court and give all parties a motion to amend the case plan consistent with the new provisions that we just talked about and do it with concurrent case planning. It has to be done within 10 business days after that order with the findings of unlikely reunification is received by the department. And the proposed case plan has to be attached to this motion. If you were already using concurrent planning and say you had reunification and legal and permanent guardianship of a dependent child, then if you're at the six-month JR and the court says it's unlikely, then the court goes to the court will no longer pursue, let me start over. If you're using concurrent planning and the court makes the finding that reunification is not necessary, then the case plan that they attached to their motion will then document the steps they're taking to accomplish the concurrent goal. So that's concurrent case planning. I'd like to just also take a second and mention that in the Chapter 39 book that you have, in the front, there is a pendency case management flow chart. And in addition to updating the way cases proceed based on the new statutes and statutes that have been enacted in the past several years, you know, there is mention of concurrent case planning, and there is a thorough description of how the case should proceed depending on which pendency option you choose. So with that, we'll go ahead and start tackling permanency and hopefully get to also TPR. On page 109 of your blue book, we have basically a complete rewrite of the permanency section, and you can essentially forget almost everything you knew about the law as it existed last year. There's one major reason for that, which is the Florida permanency options, as they were written, did not comply with federal law. Long-term licensed custody and long-term custody did not match up with the federal permanency options, and therefore could have potentially jeopardized federal funding. These new permanency options need to be learned, and they need to be used. They are now listed in order of priority. Previously, Florida law simply said that adoption was the primary permanency option. That is not what federal law says. So now Florida law is consistent with federal law. Reunification, adoption, permanent guardianship, placement with a fitting willing relative, and an APWA. One thing I want to point out about the adoption is it says if a petition for TPR has been or will be filed. That language is designed to indicate that you can be pursuing adoption and working on your adoption goal even if you're waiting for DCF, or DCF is doing, you know, working on its TPR petition. It is not, there are some circuits that have said there are people who will not begin looking for an adoptive placement until after a TPR is finalized. That is not the way the federal law is written, and now Florida law clearly reflects that. The priority listing is not just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 listed in Section 39.621, and it's not just a priority list. This concept of priority is built in throughout all of the permanency options. And you'll notice, as I've written on page 3 of the materials that you have, that the as you choose a less permanent option, it gets harder. There are more things that DCF has to, more justifications DCF has to provide to the court. There are more findings that the court has to make, and I provided you some options. If you pick something other than reunification or adoption, Section 39.621.6 requires the court to make findings as to why you're not doing this, why you're choosing this without adoption to follow. 39.6231.7, if the child is going to be placed with a fit and willing relative permanently as a permanency option, the court will continue to conduct permanency hearings to evaluate the possibility of adoption or permanent guardianship of the child. There was a lot of work put into this section to make sure that when we said, this is your permanency order, this is your permanent placement, that they truly are permanent. The last one that we'll talk about, let me go back. Also in Section 39.6231, a huge change. Relative placement continues to be supervised. You're going to be reviewing those every 6 months. They're going to be reevaluated every 12 for, you know, permanency hearings, and there is no closing out relative placement anymore. This is not the relative placement we had last year. There are a lot of findings that have to be made, and we'll go through those in a second. The other thing is a new concept called another planned permanent living arrangement, and I'll talk more in detail about that when we get to it. One thing I want to mention, though, for guardian, for all our attorneys and case coordinators, there are a lot of new findings, and there's a lot of new language that needs to be included in these orders, and we really need to be on this. We don't want a child's permanency to fall apart because the wrong words were in the order. So we've got to be looking at these orders, making sure the new language is in there, making sure the appropriate findings have been made. If there's no mention of why Aunt Sue can't be a permanent guardian, you know, maybe that needs to be investigated, and it would certainly be appropriate for guardians to take that on. Another big issue that I want to mention that's not written in these materials is there has been some discussion about what to do with children whose placement is long-term custody or long-term licensed custody or independent living today. It is the position of the Guardian Ad Litem State Office, it is the position of the Family Safety Office of the Department of Children and Families, that when these cases come up to have their judicial reviews, that those reviews will be consistent with the new statute. So if you have a child in long-term custody, that doesn't exist anymore. So orders need to be revised, new information needs to be provided to the court so that the appropriate findings can be made. And this is a place really where the Guardian Ad Litem program can do some good work for these kids. And I'll point it out more specifically when we talk about each separate permanency option. The first one is permanent guardianship. This is a new creature to Chapter 39. It is similar to a Chapter 744 guardianship, but there were a lot of technical requirements in Chapter 744 that do not apply here. If the court makes all the findings that are listed on page 112, that child's been there for the appropriate amount of time, permanent guardian is suitable, able to provide a safe and permanent placement of the home, there are 6 different findings that the court can discontinue regular review hearings and terminate supervision. The guardianship is designed to be the most permanent placement after adoption. One of the things that happened, though, unfortunately, during the bill drafting process was that an extraordinarily important piece of information was left out. And this information has already come to all of our staff by way of email. If you look on page 112 in paragraph 3, there's a reference to paragraph 2G of the statute, and it doesn't exist. In your materials, it tells you what that paragraph previously said. I've talked to all the stakeholders. Everyone that I've talked to agrees it was simply an oversight. It's important that the court's order, in order to establish the guardianship, transfer the parental rights, and it's down in the list, regarding protection, education, care and control of the person, custody, and decision-making of the on behalf of the child. The permanent guardianship order needs to say a version of that. It seems to me that if your judge is comfortable and DCF is comfortable, that it would be fine to take the language that was in 2G and to put that in the order. So please make sure when you're looking at these permanent guardianship order that it meets the definition. A legal relationship that a court creates between a child and a relative, which is intended to be permanent and self-sustaining through the transfer of certain parental rights. So that is critical. You'll have that order that lists all of the rights and duties of the guardian, and then you'll have everything else in paragraph 2 in 39.6221 sub 2 that really spells out, why couldn't this child go home? What was the problem? What's our visitation going to look like? Why are we doing this adoption? There'll be a lot of information regarding the dependency in there. The statute then provides that a second order should be drafted and signed by the court so that if the child needs to just take his or her bus home with their friend, that it can then the guardian can go into the school and say, here are my rights and duties, without getting all the other laundry list of very personal information regarding the child's dependency case. Please, when these cases come up, when you're pursuing a permanent guardianship, when you're at a JR and you're changing an old permanency goal into a permanent guardianship, please make sure for the sake of these children that these orders are entered, just for the sake of their privacy and that of their family. Another critical piece of the permanent guardianship permanency option is that if a relative wants to be a permanent guardian, they can do that and still get their relative caregiver funds. 39.5085.1c was amended to make sure that that happened, and that's on page 87 of your book. Placement of a fit and willing relative is the next one. And again, we have some findings here. Reunification and adoption are not in the not in the child's best interest. There are prerequisites that are similar to what we had with legal guardianship. One of the things that is required by this statute in order to ensure that the placement is as permanent as possible is that the guardian ad litem and DCF are required to give the court a list and description of services needed to ensure permanency. One of the big complaints among stakeholders is that these relative placements often fall apart because they don't have enough support. So this is our opportunity. If the relative placement is truly the best place for the child to be, the guardian ad litem can work with DCF and with the court to get the appropriate services in there to make sure that it's stable. You can revisit it every 6 months at your JR and again at your permanency hearing. There are, the court's order has to specify why wasn't this child returned, why is the child being permanently placed there instead of being adopted, and several other findings that are listed in the statute. In this instance and in permanent guardianship, part of the reason that these findings are so important is that there are still many rights that the parents have. Those are outlined in 39.621. It specifically says that placement in a permanent guardianship with a fit and willing relative or in an APLA does not terminate parental rights. So as many of you know, these parents often go off for 3 or 4 years and now they're back. Well, someone somewhere needs to know that during year 3 of the dependency, no, we didn't terminate parental rights, but here are the reasons why we didn't, and this is why the child couldn't go back to the parent. And if the parent comes back and it truly is not in the best interest of the child to go back to them, you want to make sure that these orders on permanency clearly spell out what the problems were, and that you're not just dealing with something that says, you know, at this time in 2006, it's in the best interest of child to be placed with grandma, and then in 2009, when you come back, nobody really can point to the fact that the parent was given 6 opportunities at drug treatment and would not go, that the parent was homeless, that the parent did this and that and the other thing. So in order to protect the child and to protect the placement, you need to make sure that these orders are complete and really spell out what's best for the child and why at this time reunification was not. Again, with relative placement, you can get this separate order that can go to non-parties. It's in 39.6231 sub 3. So please make sure that you're asking for that and getting that signed for the benefit of the child. APLAs are the last and least preferred permanency option. Someone called me and said, that's long-term foster care, right? No, it is not long-term foster care. And you can tell that specifically by the fact that in the statute, it requires the department to provide information as to why the placement will endure and how it is more stable and more secure than ordinary foster care. There is no long-term foster care permanency option. So please make sure that APLAs are not, that no one thinks an APLA is that. There's a publication called Making It Permanent that a lot of you have that's published by the American Bar Association. And the best, I tried to scan it in, but the print just would not allow for it. But the description that they give for an APLA says this: another planned permanent living arrangement is not a catch-all for whatever temporary plan is needed when none of the preferred permanency plans are practical. Rather, an APLA is a truly permanent arrangement that is the goal for the child. This is the permanency option of last resort. So please make sure everyone understands that. And the statute is set up to make sure that it is not used too liberally. You have to make the finding that reunification is not in the best interest. You have to go through and say what all the other permanent placements, why they're not in the best interest of the child. DCF has to give the assurances that I just talked about, why it's better than foster care. And then, on top of that, you have to show compelling reasons. That is a federal requirement. The compelling reasons thing is huge. It's the biggest, most severe language that that APLA contains, compelling reasons. So as you are looking at cases, and if someone is considering an APLA, it will be the guardian's job to really make sure that there is no other option for this child. You're going to continue to supervise this every 6 months, and if it looks like a relative's available or a permanent guardianship is on the horizon, that's your opportunity. Again, the guardian ad litem is responsible for providing the court with a recommended list and description of services in order to ensure that the permanency of the placement endures. So that's APLAs. I can't say in words how important it is that this is not misused. So if anyone has any questions or needs some federal backup on this, I'll give my contact information again at the end of the call. Other quick things that I want to mention about permanency: in section 39.6219, the procedure for a parent who comes back after permanency is outlined. We've never really had this before. We've had post-disposition change of custody. The language that I said earlier was important to include in the orders about why the kid can't go home and all of that. This is where that comes into play. When a parent comes back, seeking either reunification or increased contact. The court is, the statute says that the first thing the court is going to do is hold a hearing whether to reopen the case. Now, that's really only going to apply to your permanent guardianships because that's the only case that's closed. But you don't have to drag everybody in and get the kid in there, you know, in front of this parent who maybe is a good idea or isn't, as the first order of business. The court can evaluate the petition and make decisions on whether or not the court is going to reopen the case and whether or not, and then following that, look at all the facts and make determinations as to whether or not the modification of the order should be granted. Now, this is only for parents. This big deal procedure is only for parents. If there are other changes that need to be made to the order, that is handled separately in that section. There are specific findings listed in 39.621.10 that the court will need to make, but the burden here is on the parent to demonstrate that the safety, well-being, mental, physical, and emotional health of the child is not endangered. Another big important thing about permanency is that DCF is required to advise the child and the people with whom the child is going to be placed permanently about the availability of more permanent and legally secure placements. So, for example, if Aunt Sue really looks like a good placement and she doesn't really understand permanent guardianship and is worried about her relative caregiver funds, it is upon its DCF's responsibility to make sure that she understands this would be more permanency for the child, you are still okay with your funds, etc. As guardian ad litem, case coordinators, attorneys, volunteer work with families going into permanency, you should make sure that they have a full understanding of all the different options, of the financial consequences of choosing each one. And if DCF has not counseled the family yet, please make sure that that happens. TPR, I'm going to do briefly for about 7 minutes, maybe not even, and then I'll take some questions. And if the line is available, I'm available to stay on and answer questions past the 1 o'clock mark. So let me just go ahead and go through TPR. Big, 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 big changes in TPR. First of all, 39.701.90 clarifies that the court, on its own motion, may order DCF to file a TPR at the JR hearing. There was a lot of discussion about whether the court could order DCF to file a TPR. Is that a problem with the bar rules, etc.? Well, Chapter 39 clearly states that the court can do it. One thing I want to mention, I'm going to just kind of skip around here, that a lot of people from the program have asked me. The first sentence in 39.806 sub 1 that provides a list of who can file TPR that included the GAL was deleted. That is true, but that was only because it's duplicative language. It's in 39.802.1. The guardian ad litem program's authority to file a TPR is unchanged. GALs can still file a TPR if that's appropriate. There is now 39.805.5 requirements to file a petition for TPR. DCF has to file a petition within 60 days of a 12-month JR if the child does not return to the parents, if the child's been in care 15 out of the most recent 22 months, if the parent has been convicted of certain crimes which are listed in the statute, or if the court determines that no reasonable efforts to reunify are required. They must file a TPR. If any of those things happen within 60 days. Now, in the law last year, the exception to that rule was the extraordinary circumstances rule that we talked about earlier that has been deleted. That said, if at the 12-month hearing the child's not returned, DCF has to file a TPR unless there are extraordinary circumstances and then the case plan can be extended. Instead of that language, what we now have is the exceptions to the automatic filing rule in 39.805.5.2. This, I want to be clear that there is no backing off of the requirements for DCF to file this TPR. In fact, this is designed so that it will be strengthened. If the child is being cared for by a relative under 39.6231, DCF that is an exception. DCF does not have to file that. But remember, that's a permanency placement. That's not the child was placed in the with the relative at the adjudicatory hearing. That is in a permanency placement. So if you are not going to do the TPR, the child needs to be permanently placed with the relative. And all of the findings that are required by that section, which are significantly greater than what we had in the old fit and willing relative, have to be made. The other one is compelling reasons exist to not file the TPR. That's the second exception. Compelling reasons, again, big, strong federal requirement. This is, you know, the extraordinary circumstances that were listed, in the statute before were supposed to convey a very unusual circumstance. This is supposed to be as high, probably a higher standard for not filing the TPRs. If adoption is not the appropriate permanency goal, they don't have grounds for TPR, and then some other pretty unusual thing, refugee minor, international legal obligations. So please make sure that this does not appear. This is all federal language right out of ASFA. Please make sure that no one breathes a sigh of relief when they start reading these exceptions, because they're supposed to be, they're designed to be very difficult to meet. If the court or the guardian ad litem or any other party thinks that the compelling reasons are not quite compelling enough, then there is authority in the statute to ask the court to review the decision. So if the guardian ad litem, saying adoption is not in the child's best interest could possibly be the loophole to drive the truck through. Except that the court, any party, and the guardian ad litem has the ability to hold the department's feet to the fire and say, no, that's not a good enough exception. There are not compelling reasons. We haven't looked hard enough. We haven't done this, etc. So make sure you utilize these provisions if you think a child can be in a more permanent placement. Another big thing in the TPR section is that material breach of a case plan is established as a ground for TPR. And the material breach is that the parent is unlikely or unable to substantially comply with the case plan before time expires to comply with the case plan. And again, just a little reminder here, not only is it fabulous that now we have material breach spelled out in there, but also just keep in mind the time to comply with the case plan is not 12 months from case plan approval. It's 12 months from removal. So make sure everybody is aware of that. There are some other changes to be aware of. I'm just going to mention two of them, and then I'm going to take some questions. 39.810 is amended to clarify the weight to be given to potential relative placements and clarifies that having a non-adoptive placement with a relative does not get greater consideration than any other manifest best interest factor. And if the child's been in a stable pre-adoptive placement for 6 months, the availability of another replacement, including a placement with a relative, is not a ground to deny TPR. Another big deal change is that in Section 39.522, when you consider post-disposition change of custody, the court has to look at the child's continuity in the same out-of-home placement. So that those changes are both designed to address case law that has kind of come out in the last year and to clarify the intent of the legislature and to be consistent with federal law. The last thing I'll mention is that on page 117 of your book, 39.701.6a is amended to require that at the hearing, at the judicial review hearing before, I guess, the child's 17 and a half birthday, the court needs to enter an order pursuant to section 743.045, which is emancipation for purposes of signing a residential lease. This will enable children to get apartments and other kind of housing so that on their 18th birthday, they have a place to go. Please make sure, as our teenagers are aging out or need this resource, that these orders are being entered so that they have a place to live on their 18th birthday. As I said, these are not all of the changes. Most of you should have my outline of Senate Bill 1080. We've done some other materials in the newsletter. And again, I'm happy to talk to any of you. Again, my email is deborah.lacombe@gal.sl.gov. My telephone number is 850-414-2435. You can call me for anything. And if anyone has any questions now, I'll be happy to take them.